Sure is. And how about we take your phone calls this hour with Joseph Meyer as we talk about your future, your financial future, next on Coast to Coast AM. Joseph, you say if there's going to be a crisis, it could come in the nursing home care business. Tell me about that. What could happen?
Well, you know, going back again, when you and I were growing up and our grandparents became very old, no one was put in a nursing home that I remember. We kept them at home and we took care of them.
Yes, we did.
Do you remember those days,
George?
I
do, because everybody lived together in those days.
Very true. But the median cost nationally of a nursing home for a senior citizen now, on average in the United States, is $91,200 per year, George.
Wow.
Keep in mind, 50% of Americans per Social Security statistics are earning less than $28,000 a year. In the future, it's very clear no one will be able to afford nursing home care but the very wealthy. It's just too expensive for Main Street America. But did you know the average cost of a nursing home has increased about 4% a year over the last 5 years? Medicaid is now paying over 50% of the long-term care costs for senior citizens, but the government's now broke, and how long can it continue? Nursing home care over the last 5 years has risen double the rate of stated inflation. Few, if any, acknowledge this fact. And 1 year in a nursing facility now costs almost as much as 3 years' tuition at a private college.
Unbelievable.
I mean, this is just ridiculous. But the cost of the average nursing facility can vary, as you know, George, in different states. Oklahoma costs approximately $60,225 a year. Connecticut, $158,775 a year. And Alaska is the most expensive, and it's ridiculous, $281,415.
200, wow.
281, George, can you believe it?
Nobody can afford that.
No one can afford that. A one-year stay in an assisted living facility on average costs $43,200 per year. It's often the case that the person, as you know, they enter an assisted living facility, and then as time move on, they become a nursing home resident. It's insane, George.
That is a big problem. So what do kids do with their parents who may need nursing care? I guess bring them in? Bring them into the house?
Well, you know, when we were growing up, we took care of Grandma and Grandpa. We all pitched in and we took care of them because where I was born and raised, I don't remember if there were any nursing homes. And if there were, it was certainly for people that were very wealthy, and that wasn't who we were.
I wonder how many people, how many children nowadays would bring their parents in.
I did it.
I would.
Sure.
But I mean, what about the new generation? Would they?
Hopefully they'll do it, because I don't think there's any alternative. Who can afford $200,000 a year? Who can afford even $91,000 a year?
You can't do that.
It's ridiculous.
And Social Security doesn't take care of that, does it?
Oh, no, absolutely not. You know, if you qualify for Medicaid, you can't have any assets. You know, you have to have just a limited amount of money to qualify for Medicaid. I don't know how much of that Medicaid would pay because, you know, going back in the 80s, I had some friends that put parents in a nursing home. It was about $35,000, $40,000 a year in the 80s, George.
That is a crisis. Let's go to the phones. You ready, Joseph?
Yeah, I'm ready, George.
We'll go to Taylor, Michigan. Used to live there. Had a little house there, as a matter of fact. Bob is with us. Hey, Bob, good to have you back.
Hey, how you doing, George?
Good.
It's an honor to be on your show again.
Thank you.
And I just had a few questions for your guest, but you did ask him a question about where did all these people collectively go once they left their homes. And around here in Taylor, you know, they built a bunch of new subdivisions that were like between $200,000 and $300,000. And with this Barney Frank and Ted Dodd thing that was going on back then, they couldn't support it because their income wasn't high enough to even support the house payments, so they just walked away from them.
Yeah, they sure did.
And what it did was took everybody's house prices down, because the house next door to mine was like $265,000, and then the guy bought it for $90,000.
Wow. You know?
And But you know, he said the interest, I mean, the unemployment rate was 5.1, and I used to work for one of the big three as a tinsmith, and my wife's in the medical field. She's a physical therapist. So we've never missed a payment. We've never missed a car payment, anything like that. We've been surviving. You know, I work on the side doing flooring and stuff like that.
But I bet you needed both jobs to make it work, right?
Oh, yeah. I started my own business doing refinishing floors and doing floors, you know, for people.
In addition to working, yeah.
Yeah, because I lost my job at Chrysler.
You got laid off?
Yeah, and right after 2008.
Oh, geez.
So, but he said the unemployment rate is 5.1, but I'm one of those 90,000 people that cannot find a really good middle-class job as a trained skilled tradesman.
So you're out of the workforce. You're gone.
Yes, yes. I'm one of those 90,000 people that your guest had on a couple weeks ago and Trump's been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But my question to him is, we both still have our 401ks, and we, like you, we don't know that much about the gold or the silver. If you take some of that money and transfer it into gold and silver, is that paper gold and silver, or is that actual gold that
you take possession
to in a Fidelity or a Merrill Lynch 401 account? Or would you have to take that out of your savings, which a lot of people are living paycheck to paycheck, and they don't have a big savings to invest in gold and silver?
And one thing you can do is call our friends at Lear Capital. They'll give you a free book. Just get the free book and read up on that, too. But when you switch, Joseph, when you go into like an IRA of gold and silver, can you take physical possession?
I believe you can, George, but I like to keep accounts segregated, and I would keep them separate. You know, I would keep the IRA or the 401k, you know, as it is, but I would have a separate account, certainly for my physical gold and silver. I think that's the ideal way to do it, George.
All right. How much should one buy in terms of percent?
Well,
5%, 10%?
Well, everyone's situation is different, but I think when you talk about gold and silver, and I'm sure you'll agree, you want to own equally gold and silver. You know, most people buy either gold and or silver, but I think you have to own both of them.
You've got to balance that a little bit.
I think to answer your question, as a rule of thumb, at a minimum, you want to have at least 20% of your liquid assets in gold and silver, George.
Yeah. Now, the price, of course, is a huge difference. Gold is over $1,000 an ounce. Silver is a little over $14 an ounce.
Yes, it is. But I think when you look at the percentages of certainly what can happen moving forward, I believe silver will outperform gold, George. I think when you talk about the uses for silver, as you know, it's used in electronics, medical applications, batteries, solar technology, nanotechnology, photography, industrial catalysts. So silver has a lot of uses aside of a monetary metal, George.
Well, then we don't have a glut of silver on this planet, do we?
No, we don't. I think there's very little physical silver. I think, quite honestly, there's very little physical gold that's available for purchase.
Let's go to David in Taos, New Mexico. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Oh, hi, George. Hi, Joseph. Pleasure to speak with you gentlemen this evening.
Thank you, sir.
Joseph, I believe you said early in the show that the high corporate tax rate in the United States of 39% is something of a problem for our economy.
Yes.
And I'm no economist by any stretch, but I've heard quite often some people contend that with the breaks in the tax code that no corporations pay that, and some corporations actually pay no income tax. So I'd like to hear your comments on that point of view.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, and I think the tax code is very complicated. I'm not an expert, as I'm sure you'll agree, on tax matters, and I know a lot of companies pay very little or no taxes. I think, you know, when you take a look at the provisions of the tax code, it allows them to do that. But I think when you speak at the level of 39.1%, that's the basic tax rate on which is the maximum that corporations pay in the United States, George.
Well, I got to tell you, I think we should be revamping our tax code.
Yes.
And dramatically revamp it, maybe even go to a use tax, give vouchers to some
overdue.
People. Yep, we got to do something. Somebody's got to be creative enough to have the guts to do that. How would you rate, Joseph, I don't care if you're a Republican, Democrat, Libertarian, whatever, but how would you have rated George Bush in his administration?
Well, I think he was a good man. He certainly kept the country very safe. And, you know, we had an economy that was growing under George Bush. You know, certainly we moved forward. And through the years, people have taken on now huge burdens of debt. And we've seen the economy not certainly create and offer the decent paying jobs that everybody thought we would certainly see as we move forward. I think at some point, George, we're going to have to rebuild the infrastructure of America, and we're going to finally get those shovel-ready jobs. We're going to put some people back to work.
But the bottom fell out during the end of his administration.
Yes, it did.
He didn't see that coming, did he?
No, he didn't.
No. And how do you think President Obama has done to handle that? Because he got handed it.
Well, you know, when President Obama came into office, he talked about rebuilding America's crumbling infrastructure, and he talked about the shovel-ready jobs. And you know, they never materialized. I think we could have built new bridges. I think we could have repaired and built new dams and levees. We could have repaired and rebuilt our tunnels. We could have rebuilt and improved our highways. We could have upgraded our sewer systems. We could have upgraded our power grid to increase electricity. We could have updated our railroad transit systems. We could have modernized our ports, and we could have remodeled our aging schools and universities. We didn't do any of it, George.
No, we did not. That's a good point. Okay, let's go to Paul in Seattle. Welcome to the show, Paul. You're on the air with us. Go ahead.
Wow, thanks for taking my call, George.
Sure thing.
Good evening, Mr. Meyer. I just have I'm going to go the conspiratorialist route here tonight, George. What are these three countries, Iran, North Korea, and the Sudan, they're not under they're the last three countries to be under let's just say the one world currency. And I'll take my answer off the air, but I want to make a comment. George, I took Biden's advice, and I went and followed my dream, so I'm an artist now, and I draw welfare and unemployment. Thank you.
All right. I like that. I don't know about Iran, North Korea, and the Sudan, Joseph, in terms of where they're at with things. Do you?
No, not really, George.
Okay. Your silence told me everything I needed to hear. Let's go to Mark in Chico, California now. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
George, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm. My pleasure.
And Joe, wow, listening to you, you're very intelligent. I have two questions. One's about the price of oil. And the other one's about raising interest rates this month. You know, they want to do liftoff, but not. Which one do you want to talk about first?
Well, how about that? He's giving you a choice, Joseph.
Well, let's talk about oil.
All right, let's talk about oil. So the price of oil, obviously, we hit a low at 38. It's been hovering to 49. We're kind of right in the middle, you know, 44 or whatnot. Do you see the price of oil getting down to 25, like a lot of speculators are saying? I really think that, you know, the Saudis, you know, they don't want to cut production. You know, we heard that months ago. And also, I kind of call some of these zombie oil producers that these banks are holding up in fracking here in America, you know, they got to make money at a certain price. So we have some banks that are holding on to these oil companies. So where do you see the price of oil going into December?
Well, let me give you three support levels, and let me give you two resistant levels that you can watch as I think certainly things unfold. We will see oil move to these price levels.
Mm-hmm.
Support level for oil, you have $42, $37.50, and then $35 a barrel.
Mm-hmm.
Resistant levels are $50 and then $55 a barrel. So what I'm saying is if we've seen the lows, oil can be expected to move back up to the $50, $55 a barrel area certainly very quickly. And I think we have seen the lows, although we may retest them one more time.
But it seems like Brent crude's moving in close.
Yes, it is.
It is. And that shows the global slowdown.
Yes.
Okay. All right. So my next question is about interest rates. You know, the liftoff, they were thinking about September. I've been watching all this stuff happening. You know, just within the next few days, or these past few days, even though it's Labor Day weekend, I'm almost for interest rate hike, and I thought they couldn't do it. But the global slowdown is so, you know, America's kind of stagnant. Like you said, the 10% off, you know, it's not much. I mean, it's been 6 years of a bull run. But the stagnant American economy right now, it's still stagnant. And, you know, someone has to move. Someone's got to move this castle because it's too stagnant. So what do you think about interest rates this month? Because I think the Fed, we don't know what China's going to be doing today on the markets. We don't know how they're going to finish. In the next few days, we'll see how, like tomorrow morning, how, you know, the Dow, what's going to happen.
Yeah, they're a little skittish. I think the Fed is scared to raise interest rates, Joseph.
I think they're being very cautious. They want to digest all the economic data, and they want to be sure before they move. But I don't think it's a question any longer if rates will go up. It's a question of just when they do. Whether we see it in September or we see it in early 2016 is not going to really make all that much difference, George. I really don't believe it.
All right. Thank you, Mark. Appreciate you being on the program. A couple minutes to go, and then let's take one more, and then we'll take remaining calls when we come back. Robert in Denver, first-time caller. Robert, go ahead.
Hey, thank you, George, from one Navy man to another.
Thank you.
I want to ask a question first, but I want to preface this. I've been in finance for almost my whole life. I used to cold call for E.F. Hutton when I was 14. Used to be a stockbroker at Shearson, which doesn't exist anymore. Used to be a stockbroker in Merrill, which went under.
You're the wolf of Wall Street.
Pretty much every, I was a commodities trader for a couple firms that went under too. And from what I've seen, you know, this whole entire country has completely collapsed. And almost every corporation, major corporation, has went bankrupt. So as far as going from this point on, I disagree with some of the things your guest is saying. I don't believe they're going to raise rates because this economy will totally fall to pieces. And I think the Fed has kind of ran out of tricks. But my question to him is, how do you think this is going to reset? How are they going to possibly reset this? That's my question.
Well, I think when you take a look at the currencies of the world, we're certainly going to see a global reset. We're going to see a global reset in all asset classes. You know, these interest rates are now down to the levels we haven't seen since the 1930s. You know, at some point they've got to go up. I think they're going to go up very slowly.
We should be doing better, but we're not.
No, we're not, George. You know, the economic prosperity we've witnessed on Wall Street never filtered down to the pocketbooks of middle-class America, and that's one of the biggest problems we have, and it's continuing.
The banks held on to the profits. They didn't
lend.
Yes,
they did.
Unbelievable. Joseph, we're going to come back in a moment here on Coast to Coast AM, and we're going to take some final phone calls. What a fast night this is going. And then next hour, we talk about some strange creatures. But we'll be back with Joseph Meyer and your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast AM. Joseph Meyer with us, our final segment just ahead with your phone calls. Okay, welcome back to Coast, Joseph Meyer with us. So, Joseph, someone's going to be right. Either it's going to be a rosy picture for everybody or it's going to be a disaster. I don't think there's going to be any middle ground here.
No, I couldn't agree with you more, George. You know, I've been in these markets 50 years. People don't think I'm that old, but I got into markets in 1966. I was 19 years old. I went up on Wall Street in 1972. I was a fully licensed broker. I was 25.
You're the wolf of Wall Street.
I guess I am. You know, I just had my birthday at the end of August. I'm 69 years old. I've seen
Good
it all
you.
In my career, George.
You sure have. You sure have. And I have a feeling, Joseph, you're going to still see some more.
I think we will.
Yeah. Let's hope so, huh? Let's go to Greg in Central Valley, New York. It's your turn, Greg. Thank you. Go ahead.
Good morning, gentlemen. Joe, your suggestion earlier about a couple of companies that you were interested in included AT&T, which surprised me, considering their recent acquisition of a satellite television company. It just smacks of the days of Motorola, way back picking up radio, you know, scanners, data scanners, and trying to diversify itself way off of its core mission, and that's resulted in Motorola having a lot of problems and almost breaking up. I'm not sure that AT&T is doing the smart thing with picking up, I think it was Dish Network recently. I'm curious about your assessment on that, how that factors in.
Well, number one, AT&T is one of the most widely held stocks in the country. It's a very conservative stock. It has a long history of paying a very fine dividend. We used to call it grandma stock many years ago.
Right.
But I think when you look at the companies that I named, these are defensive stocks for portfolio consideration. If we do re-enter recession and we do see some tough times, I think these companies and ones similar to them are going to weather the storm extremely well. As far as them divesting now and going in a different direction, I think it's been long overdue, certainly when you talk about AT&T.
When you look at some of these other companies, I know my dad used to love utilities because of the dividends in those days. Stock didn't appreciate much, but the dividends always stayed solid. Are those still pretty good?
Well, I think when you look again at a total return, George, as you know, you want growth and you want income. You want share appreciation and you want dividend. And I think utilities are certainly an area that can continue to do that and do that safely so you can sleep at night.
Okay, back to the calls we go. Chris is in Austin, Texas. Hello, Chris. Go ahead.
Hello, George. I just want to say, first of all, thank you. I'm a big fan of the show. I appreciate you having me on.
Thank you. Thank you.
I have to admit, though, I was a little offended by some of the comments that Mr. Meyer was saying earlier, and me being a 32-year-old man with a family, talking about, you know, how in his generation, when, you know, a parent got sick or needed help, they moved them into the house. Well, you know, he just said he was 69. Well, 37 years ago, when he was 32, it was possible for someone with a college education to get a job and support their family. Right now, my wife and I both have college educations. We both have good jobs with benefits and everything, and we are check to check. We had to move in with my parents to be able to pay off her student loans and save up enough money to buy even a starter house. So if my dad were to die and my mom come down with dementia, I mean, what are we supposed to do? You know, we both work all day long to support us and our three kids. So now all of a sudden my mom is sick. Are we supposed to put her in daycare? I mean, we, you know, quit one of our jobs. I think that's the problem, that a lot of older people look at millennials and say, well, they're lazy. They can't. Well, no, the economy is different now. We can't afford the things that our parents' generation was able to do. There is no man bringing home the bacon with a housewife taking care of the home. That does not exist anymore. It's most families these days are dual income families, and that's the only way that it can work. Otherwise, we're living in absolute poverty. So what am I supposed to do when one of my parents gets sick? Is it me or my wife that quits her job? Or do we suck it up and put them in assisted living? Because I don't honestly see any other option.
Fair enough questions, Joseph. Go ahead.
Well, you know, we lived an era, George. It's over and done. We'll never see it again, I believe, certainly in our lifetime. And we did for our parents what had to be done, and we were able to do it at a time which allowed people like you and I to do it. The economy is far different now, certainly, than when I took care of my parents going back, you know, over 30 years ago. It was a much, much different time. And I know people now are struggling. The economy has not been strong, and I know certainly they're having difficulty now, you know, finding the decent paying jobs and having the disposable income and certainly being able to do the things you and I did at a different time in our life. So I certainly understand the frustration. I basically said what I did, certainly what I witnessed my parents did for our grandparents. And again, it was a different time, George. You know, these times don't allow, you know, anyone to do the things that we once did, because we certainly had to do them and there was no alternative. But well, I didn't mean to offend anyone.
No, I know you're not doing that on purpose. Not to offend.
No.
That's not you.
Not me, George.
Ontario, Canada's turn. International caller James, you're on the air.
Hey, George. I'm a second-time caller. I hope all my drivers from Yellow Cab are listening. How are you doing today, George?
All is good.
Yeah, I got a question about the economy relating to like wages and the cost of living, how the inflation's going up.
Okay.
Like years ago, you know, it was so cheap for everything, but you made $4 an hour, or like $2 an hour way back in the day. And now, you know, you see everything costs more, and on top of that, like, you make more money. They always raise the minimum wage. Like, the minimum wage increase has an effect on the cost of living and inflation. And that, because we're at the point that they cancel the Canadian penny. Like, the Canadian penny is no longer in production.
They don't need it anymore, like, do they?
No.
That's what's the minimum wage in Canada, Jim?
$11 an hour it's going up to.
What is it here, Joseph? Do you know?
$7.25, George.
Wow. I think some fast food places are going to kick it up even higher on their own, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
Is that smart business? Maybe it is.
Well, I think it's smart business insofar as being able to get decent people who want to take these jobs. But, you know, when you talk about wages adjusted for inflation, they've been flat since 1965, George.
Well, that's true. But, I mean, here's James. He's a cab driver. He's in Canada. You know, maybe he has to pay for his own gasoline. I'm not sure. But how
everything is just too high, George. The cost of everything is now so high, and the ability of people to earn a decent wage to be able to keep up is becoming extremely difficult. I think it's very clear whether you're in Canada or you're in the U.S.
See, I think all of this was done on purpose, Joseph. I don't think these people are stupid. I think they know what they're doing, and for some reason they have an agenda, and they're doing it.
Well, they may be doing it, but the country is now, I think, digging in their heels, and we're starting to see anger now boil over with the frustration of people not being able to certainly support their families. I think it's coming to an end, George, and it has to end.
Something's got to happen. And presidential elections, how do you like so far the candidates?
Kind of early, you know. I think when we see the first primaries and we see certainly a good voter turnout, I think it's going to tell us an awful lot. You know, I enjoy all the candidates, but I certainly would like to see more specifics, and I think you would agree we need to know, you know, what their plan is on a lot of issues as we move forward.
All right, let's take some more calls here. We go to Carlos in Carson, California. Hey, Carlos, go ahead.
Good evening, good evening. Well, listen, I was a realtor back in the 2000s, and when I saw the extreme facilitation of credit that the Federal Reserve was providing for real estate loans, for instance, there's something called the stated income loan, which came in around 2002-2003, whereby potential buyers could just put anything they wanted on the application. A McDonald's worker could put, oh, I make $1,000 a year, and the banks would not verify that.
That's we call them liar loans.
They would accept it. Well, let me finish here, please. Now, so that created thousands and thousands and thousands of people buying mortgages, buying homes they could not afford. The Federal Reserve Board knew these people were going to lose their homes. They knew it. And look at the aftermath. Why did they do it? Why? Because when you look at the aftermath of this whole crisis, what happened? Bank of America swallowed Countrywide, which was one of the biggest suppliers of mortgage loans to these subprime candidates. It swallowed Merrill Lynch also that folded. And it was done with bailout money. You had Wells Fargo that, I think, swallowed Washington Mutual, which also collapsed. You get J.P. Morgan Chase that swallowed some other bank. So the moral of the story is, the banks got bigger with bailout money, and that's been traditionally the pattern that the banking industry, the elites of the banking industry, the Rothschilds, Rockefellers, going back to the you know, the 1800s. They've been doing that every 20 years to create facilitation of credit, rising inflation, and then with the market forces take place and the decline occurs, and all these people go bankrupt, they swallow up all the assets. And that's what they've been doing. They're going to do another one here pretty soon.
Well, there's no question. The banks, and we were talking about that earlier, Carlos, after the bailout, they did not lend money to people. They kept it. And I think, Joseph, in some cases, they're still doing that, aren't they? They're still keeping
it. When you talk about small business ownership, do you know in the United States it's at the lowest level, George, that's ever been recorded?
Oh, I know. I mean, I use the cities that I've lived in, Minneapolis, Detroit, St. Louis. They used to have some quality small businesses. I mean,
yes,
in St. Louis, for example, used to be the hat capital of the world. They used to make shoes there. They used to manufacture them. And
good quality products.
They're gone.
They're gone, yeah.
Everything's overseas. Everything's overseas. When it became cheaper to make it and ship it, as opposed to make it and keep it, that's when we were up the creek.
It was the beginning of the end, George.
Yep, absolutely. The shipping in of all these containers with all these goods at a cheaper price than what it cost to make it here, that did us in.
Destroyed America.
Truck driving in Texas, Jim's turn on Coast to Coast. Hello, Jim. Join us.
Hey, George and Joseph. Great show tonight.
Thank you.
I had a question. I need some advice. Health insurance. Is there any way to save money on that? I'm a truck driver. I'm healthy. My wife is healthy. We got a 3-year-old daughter. She was born with a heart condition. And our health insurance is $800 a month. That does not include dental, does not include vision. Like I said, we are healthy. I've been to the hospital twice throughout my entire life. Once was when I was a teenager, and another time was about 4 or 5 years ago, and I'm still paying that bill off, and I had insurance then. My health insurance is literally more than my mortgage and my car payment combined.
Jeez.
How old are you?
I'm sorry?
How old are you?
I am 30, going to turn 31 later this year.
Well, you know, I would shop around because rates vary one company to another, and there could be a wide disparity based on what you're telling me between policies that could be issued by different companies. I'd shop around. I think you can do better than what you're paying.
Is it high, Jim, because of your daughter's heart condition?
Actually, no, it's not. I'm not sure what the issue is because I did do shopping around. I even tried going through Medicaid because they have the FloridaKids.org, and they even told me just my daughter alone was $300 a month because of how much money that I make. My wife had to quit her job to take care of our daughter.
Yeah.
So we lost that income.
And I'm
still making like 50 grand a month, but or a year, but we are literally living paycheck to paycheck because of the insurance. The insurance is what's killing us.
Sure. And you're an independent trucker?
No, I'm a company driver.
Oh, you are.
It's through our company.
They don't give you, they give you benefits, but you still have to pay that much?
Yeah, they actually pay about $400 towards the insurance every month. But I still end up paying, like I said, about $800.
Wow. I mean, are other employees paying about the same thing you are?
Yes and no, because it depends on the size of the family. There's only 3 of us. For example, my dad, he also works for the same company. He is paying about $600, but it's just him and his wife, or my mom. So
man,
it's still, but then I'm not sure if it's a Florida thing. Again, I tried doing the Florida Blue, Blue Shield, Blue Cross. I tried what's the United Healthcare, and
yeah,
they were all within a range of about $100, depending on the deductible that we can
my
choose
gosh
for, as well as the percentage of what they're willing to cover. It was actually cheaper at my daughter because some of the medicine that she's taking caused cavities in her mouth that had to get filled. It was cheaper to actually fly to Nicaragua, have them done there, and fly back. All 3 of us went on a week's vacation, and we saved $3,000 compared to what it would have cost in Florida.
Well, you did the smart thing.
And again, we can afford that, but we are still living paycheck to paycheck because of these worries that we're having. You know, if my dad or my grandpa needed help, they can come live with us. As you guys were talking about, taking care of our older folk, we had no problem doing that. I'm trying to get the family together because each individual immediate family member has assets enough that we could sell, buy a bigger house, and all of us just live together, and we could easily have enough money. We're not going to have to worry about anything in the future.
Yeah, but it's the insurance.
If something was to happen, just my grandma, you know, breaks her shoulder or something, well, now that puts us in a bind for 6 months where we're losing whatever money that we're trying to save. And with this health insurance, it's killing us. And with the Obamacare, I have no problem me losing insurance or my wife because, again, we don't go to the doctor. Even we did go to the doctor like once a year for our yearly stuff, but even that still costs us $200 after insurance. And we were like, well, we're not going to the doctor anymore. We just have our daughter go because she needs it for her heart condition. And she requires a CAT scan and an echo twice a year. Our insurance says no, we'll pay for it once a year. So, again, for those particular procedures, we've taken her to Nicaragua. We just have them translate to English, and we bring it back to Florida. And the doctor said, the heart doctor says that we're okay with that. We'd rather you do it with us, but we understand the money situation that you're in.
Well, let's ask you, Joseph, I got a minute left. If you can address health insurance, it's still a disaster, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It sounds like an awful lot of money, $800 a month for health care. You know, that's more than a mortgage on a good-sized house, George. It's ridiculous.
Well, it sure is.